Hi, this is Donna Shapley, and I thank you so much for joining me today as we take our final look at the August issue of Cincinnati Magazine. I would like to begin today by concluding the featured story this month entitled Peace, Love, and a Little Understanding, The Naked Truth About What It Was Like to Attend Woodstock in 1969 by John Stowell. Getting to the festival site was a problem for many of the musicians as well. Woodstock was slated to kick off with a performance by Sweetwater, Motherless Child, but the psychedelic folk band was caught in the traffic. So it fell to Richie Havens, who had already arrived, to sound the first chimes of freedom from the stage. Wood was about 10 rows from the stage. "We got right in it," he says. "People were standing everywhere, and there was hardly room to move. We were excited, arms up in the air. It's just a blur now." Lenhart was also close to the stage and remembers being mesmerized by Havens. "That African garb," she marvels. He wore these sandals and stomped his feet as he played. He was a big man, you know, so you couldn't help but watch him. Havens would go on to sing for more than an hour, killing time until Sweetwater finally arrived by helicopter. And then came the rains. What began as a light shower on Friday night turned into a torrent that only adds to the Woodstock legend. At the time, it was miserable. "We made it into Life magazine because of the weather," says Steve Schumacher, a former Cincinnati nonprofit leader who recently moved to Connecticut. The magazine photo shows him and a group of five others holding a piece of 4-foot by 8-foot plywood over their heads to fend off the downpour. He was working a summer job in the Oberlin College cafeteria when a student told him about Woodstock. Schumacher's parents were out of town on vacation, but he had a 62 Ford Falcon, and the student had bought 2 tickets at Tower Records. They threw caution to the wind, of course, and drove to New York with a couple of friends, arriving in Bethel 3 days before the festival started. "My friend Roger immediately got high as a kite and was taking anything he could get his hands on," remembers Schumacher. "People were selling just about everything." From the stage came between act announcements like, "Do not take the brown pills. The blue pills are okay, but do not take the brown pills." "That was bad acid," says Wood, "and a lot of the time people simply didn't know what they were ingesting." As the rain intensified into the wee hours of Saturday morning, people scrambled to find a place to sleep. Lenhart huddled in her tent, but water seeped in and soaked her sleeping bag. Schumacher remained exposed to the elements, opting to stay on the plywood overnight in front of the stage. Wood and his wife found an unlocked Coca-Cola truck. It was empty, but the cargo area had been sectioned off in compartments for tightly packing the cases of glass bottles it carried. Wood compresses his body into a near-fetal position to demonstrate how he and his wife tucked themselves into 2 compartments and spent a restless but dry night. "We got up the next morning and looked around, and it was muddy as hell," he says. "Wet everywhere. People were higher than kites. It was just a giant pot thing. People were running around naked. It was innocent, but by noon, I knew it was going to be terrible. So we started walking out. They hiked 12 miles back to the car they'd abandoned the day before, joining hundreds of others who apparently decided they preferred civilization and a hot shower over psychedelics and starvation. Little did Schumacher know, but his time at Woodstock was about to end as well. He recalls a soggy but beautiful dawn on Saturday morning with the last strains of Joan Baez's Joe Hill from the night before still ringing in his head. At 9 a.m., someone on stage grabbed the mic and announced, "Steve and Roger, Eric is sick and going home." They raced back to their tent a mile or two away, and Eric was indeed sick, homesick. Even today, after all this time, it's not hard to say to him, "You owe us," Schumacher says, sighing. Lenhart and Griffin stuck it out for the rest of the weekend, and both ended up making it into the 1970 film Woodstock, the director's cut, and seeing themselves on the silver screen a year later at the Albee Theater downtown. Griffin's appearance was so fleeting that he initially missed it. Lenhart's moment was more prominent, and she remembers standing up in the dark movie palace and whooping, "That's me!" She had been skinny dipping in Filipino pond on the farm, trying to wash off layers of mud, when a reporter came up to her in a rowboat and began asking her questions. Lenhart is sure her responses were absurd. "I even spoke with an accent and sounded British," she says, and her scene would have been left on the cutting room floor, except that, at the last minute, she spontaneously shouted, "We're taking over," while looking at the camera. 10 days later, a flatbed truck pulled up to the Cincinnati Zoo, and weary workers unloaded a set of mammoth, mud-splattered speakers. They now belong to Jim Tarbell, who planned to use them at his once-and-only Midwest Mini Pop Festival. They now belong to Jim Tarbell, who planned to use them at his once and only once Midwest Mini Pop Festival. Cincinnati's future vice mayor was preparing to open the Ludlow Garage Rock Club, and he thought an outdoor music festival would be a unique PR opportunity. Already a well-known music promoter, he'd traveled to New York earlier in the year to shadow Bill Graham, the nation's most successful rock and roll ringmaster. That's where he met Bill Hanley, who told Tarbell he could provide him a speaker set after this event no one ever heard of. Hanley was driving all of the Woodstock sound equipment out to California and would be happy to stop in Cincinnati to offload some of it. The Midwest Mini Pop Festival made a second connection to Woodstock once rain turned the zoo grounds into a muddy mess. Drugs were plentiful, and a few over-exuberant fans climbed a fence and walked on top of the ape house. Zoo officials were not amused. Woodstock was the surprise final chapter of a turbulent decade, a gathering of more than 500,000 soaked people, free of violence and full of drug-addled hope. While the festival featured a series of mistakes and miscalculations, it worked itself out mostly because everyone wanted it to. Wood believes the sheer size of the crowd made everyone cautious. Maybe it was the pot, which tends to calm people down, and maybe it was the rain and the hunger creating the kind of camaraderie one feels when faced with a common adversity. Or it could have been the nakedness, he says with a big grin. Pretty girls taking their clothes off? That's always fun. And naked people really don't make much mischief. And with that, we conclude John Stowell's featured story, Peace, Love, and a Little Understanding. Next, I would like to turn to Front Lines with Seeds of Change, How People's Liberty Rocked Philanthropy by Putting the Catalyst for Change Directly into the Hands of the Greater Cincinnati Community by Lile Soku. I had no idea how successful it would be, says C. Jacqueline Wood, one of the first recipients of a $15,000 Globe grant from People's Liberty in 2015. The founder and director of the Mini Micro Cinema, or the Mini, as she affectionately calls it, she used the funds to transform the small storefront outpost of People's Liberty's office at 1805 Elm Street into a fully functioning art house cinema, complete with popcorn and theater-style seating. An artist and filmmaker, Wood felt Cincinnati was missing a strong alternative cinema community and dreamed of screening films outside the mainstream for free and paying those filmmakers. The Mini became a microcosm of People's Liberty's larger philanthropic ethos. Give funding power directly to the people with big ideas instead of organizations and established nonprofits. Then empower those people to make changes they want to see in their community. The inspiration of this thing is really, could we do philanthropy differently? Could we do community development in philanthropy differently? Could we invest in a place by investing in people directly? Says Eric Avner, CEO of People's Liberty. I think we've made a difference. I think we've changed some culture. I think we've raised some eyebrows. We've had people question, what can philanthropy do? It doesn't have to always be the traditional methods, and I think we've sort of set a course for what place-based philanthropy looks like in a community like Cincinnati. Started in August 2014 and powered by the Carol Ann and Ralph V. Hale Jr. U.S. Bank Foundation, People's Liberty set a limit of 5 years of experimentation to answer questions Avner and the core PL team, including Jake Hodesh, Aurore Fournier, and Megan Trishler, posed. What does a foundation outpost look like? How can that outpost engage people directly? What's the best way to do that? The basic outline of funding boiled down to year-long $100,000 Hale fellowships, $15,000 Globe grants to transform the office white box space on Elm Street, and $10,000 project grants. To date, more than $1.9 million has been awarded via 64 project grants, 11 fellowships, and 17 Globe grants. Almost any idea was game. Start a newspaper for incarcerated individuals, like PL fellow Tracy Brumfield's Rise? Absolutely. open a Turkish coffee house, and have Globe grantee Melissa Eidegan's mother tell your fortune? Why not? Create a mobile sound studio and instrument showroom like Project Grant recipient Rochelle Kaplan? Go for it. People's liberty became a byword for the community-conscious crowd, an opportunity to invigorate not only the Elm Street location, but the greater Cincinnati community as a whole. If you're any business in town, you pick up the newspaper and your young, talented manager of whatever reads about something in this city that was sparked by an encounter or a collision at people's liberty. You suddenly feel like you're in a place where incredible things can happen, says Brendan Call, Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. Then you start to think, how do I take this into the four walls of my organization? Call calls that a big culture change, because I think it has inspired people to think differently about solving problems, and also inspired people to think differently about how they invest in their community. Talent, which is what we're focused on at the Chamber on a day-to-day basis, wants to be in a community where things like people's liberty exist. In late 2018, with the final year of people's liberty in sight, Avner and his crew started to research and design what he called a 2.0 version. Replicating a successful business model is a sound move, but is it possible to recapture lightning in a bottle? It was just one day in January when it was like, wait a minute, what are we doing? Is this going to just create a mediocre sequel, or is this going to be as remarkable and jaw-dropping and interesting and groundbreaking as the original, Avner says. And if it wasn't, we were doing it a disservice by continuing it. Ultimately, the group decided not to move forward with a second iteration. All final grant programs under People's Liberty are set to wrap up by Labor Day. Events are planned in early November to share the findings of the experiment and celebrate its time in the community. But some fruits of the program will live on. The Mini, for example, has a brick-and-mortar home now in Over the Rhine, as does Globe Grant recipient Julia Fisher's Play Library. And the spirit People's Liberty brought to the city isn't likely to die off anytime soon. Instead of, what are we going to do next? It's, what are you going to do next, Avner says. You have this network of people and a new skill set of building something pretty interesting. What are you going to do with it next? And that concludes Frontlines, Seeds of Change by Lila Skoku. Next up is Speakeasy, Guided by Choices. If you're at a music festival in Cincinnati, there's a good chance Bill Donabedian had something to do with it. The 52-year-old Milford resident and longtime local drummer Crosley, Meserly, and Ewing co-founded Midpoint and started Bunbury. He remains a minority owner. Next up, Bellwether, which brings the likes of Guided by Voices, Cake, and Beach House to Renaissance Park in Waynesville, which happened in its second edition, August 9th and 10th. Having sold Bunbury, did you have the itch to get right back in the game, or is Bellwether something that you wanted to do anyway? Really, the guys who own the Renaissance Festival approached me. It seemed like an awesome place to have a festival, but with camping because of all their property. And I had met this guy, Patrick Ryan, who books Daryl's House, the upstate New York club owned by Daryl Hall. We had hit it off, and he had never done a festival. So, when this opportunity came up, I called him right away. What makes Bellwether different? I really wanted to get back to the idea of a truly alternative music festival, find some great up-and-coming acts, as well as some existing bands with staying power. A combination of giving people something they didn't know about and something they can get excited about. A lot of festivals are trying to be everything to everyone. I mean, come on. What the hell is Ariana Grande doing playing Coachella? If you're going to have fans come back, you need to be consistent. You've got to tell a story. What are you most personally excited about this year? I'm a big GBV fan. I think Bob Pollard crafts the perfect 2-minute pop song, hook after hook after hook. I'm a sucker for that. And I'm excited about Beach House. Patrick was all over that. He's like, I'm telling you, these guys are awesome. They're selling out here. They're selling out here. We've got to get them. It's going to be the perfect music for the night. And I think he's right. Did you camp last year? Or are there VIP digs for staff? Well, I wouldn't call it VIP, but I wasn't in a tent. How about that? And that concludes Guided by Choices by Jason Cohen. Next up, transportation, staying connected. A local food tour embraces the streetcar, creating a one-of-a-kind experience for participants, by Grace Deering. When the Cincinnati Bell Connector launched in 2016, the city buzzed. Reactions were mixed. Among some excitement, many residents questioned if this form of public transportation could be as successful in Cincinnati as it is in other cities. The last 2 years of the connector's operation suggest no. Streetcar ridership declined by roughly 50,000 passengers. Mike and Laura Noyes, owners of Riverside Food Tours, are hopeful those numbers will reverse. The couple recently jumped at the opportunity to include the streetcar in their Tasty Tours. Many people have never been on the streetcar, Laura says. After our tour, they'll walk away with an all-day pass to continue to explore the city. Throughout August, Riverside's streetcar food tour transports riders to 5 to 6 eateries in the downtown area, from the banks to over the Rhine, 4 days a week. Laura says she's driven by her passion of helping people experience Cincinnati's ever-changing landscape in new ways. She encourages people to embrace the streetcar's unique experience. Our public tours max out, so using a different form of public transportation wouldn't accommodate enough people. The streetcar has been very well suited to our needs. We'll turn next to books and City Stories. Three recent releases explore the lives of innovative, accomplished, and infamous Cincinnatians from our rich past by Patrick Murphy. The Ghosts of Eden Park by Karen Abbott. Some people claim the ghost of a woman in black haunts the Eden Park gazebo. But who is she? Karen Abbott knows. She pored over every book, article, and court transcript, one running 5,500 pages, she could find to tell the ultimately tragic story of bootlegger Supreme George Remus and his woebegone wife, Imogene. Along the way, Abbott introduces you to pioneering lawyer Mabel Walker Willebrandt, who pursued Remus, and FBI agent Franklin Dodge, who almost ran away with Imogene. It's a richly detailed and haunting, if you believe Imogene still hangs out at the gazebo, story for the ages. Maria Longworth Storer, From Music and Art to Popes and Presidents by Constance J. Moore and Nancy M. Broerman. There's no question Maria Longworth Storer did a lot for Cincinnati's art community. At 21, she came up with the idea for and raised funds to support a little event called the May Festival. At 29, she created Rookwood Pottery. Now, historian Moore and archivist Broerman reveal newly discovered letters detailing her involvement with international diplomacy between the Vatican and President Theodore Roosevelt. Published 170 years after her birth, this book reveals another side of a true Renaissance woman. And Play Hungry, The Making of a Baseball Player by Pete Rose. There's no denying Pete Rose remains a complicated figure. He contributed a lot of literal legwork to the Big Red Machine, but he was also banned from the sport for betting on the game while he was in it. Here, Rose provides fans a glimpse of his life in and around the game. Why did he always run on ball four? You could thank the St. Louis Cardinals' Enos Slaughter. Young Pete watched him hustle in the 1950s. But it was his father who made it stick. The faster you get there, Pete remembers him saying, the faster you're going to touch that home plate. And with that, we conclude our look at the August edition of Cincinnati Magazine. This is Donna Shapley thanking you again for being with me today and inviting you back next week when we'll begin reading from the September issue of Cincinnati Magazine.